The rotation of life and comedy. That's what's coming up on The Art of Bombing, episode 213.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Hello, friends, and welcome to a brand new episode of The Art of Bombing. I'm your host, Dan Bublitz Jr., because it is my podcast. As always, it is Tuesday, July 27th, 2021. I hope everybody had a fantastic week. We've got a great episode of the podcast today. I have a fantastic guest. Today, my guest is Mike Kaplan. You may recognize the name from being a finalist on Last Comic Standing. You may recognize the name from an appearance on America's Got Talent. And if you live in the Twin Cities area, you may recognize the name because he's headlining Acme Comedy Club all this week. From July 28th to July 31st, you can catch him at Acme Comedy Club. So if you're in the Twin Cities area, I highly recommend you go check out his show. He's working on a new hour, and we talked a little bit about that in the podcast, along with a bunch of other things. And I want to give a shout-out to my pal, Brett Singer, who's a great comedian from New York that helped put me in touch with Mike. He made the connection. Brett's going to be, hopefully, a future guest of the podcast, but he also has his own podcast, you know, Comics Who Love Comic Books, which is one of my favorite podcasts, so go check that out and support Brett. Again, thanks, Brett, and I look forward to having you on this podcast, but thank you for making this connection. All right, on to some of the business before we get into this great conversation with Mike. We got the Dan on the Run comedy tour is plugging right along. I just got back yesterday from three shows in South Dakota and North Dakota, and they were fun and fantastic, and I had a good time driving all over, put like 1,600 miles on my car, and now I'm home for a day, and then tomorrow I'm going to be leaving for Montana. I'm going to spend a couple days visiting family, and then I've got some shows out in Montana as well. July 30th, you can catch me in Bozeman, Montana, and July 31st, which is Saturday, you can catch me in Billings, Montana. And all the information on venues, tickets, things like that, that's all on my website, danbublitz.com. So go check that out to get information. If you know people in Montana, or if you're a fan and you live in Montana, come to one of these shows. It would be great to meet people who listen to this podcast in Montana, or anywhere else for that matter. I still got a handful of shows left before I do the album recording at the end of August. So catch one of those shows. For the complete tour schedule, go to danbublitz.com. It's all there. August 7th, 2021, I will be doing from 1 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon. I'll be giving another electronic press workshop. The workshop is called How to Build an EPK for Your Success, and I help give tools to make a really good EPK that's going to leave an impression on people who look at it. So, and who use it. It's going to give you insight on what you should have in it, what you shouldn't, things like that. So if you're interested in that, you can go to blitzedentertainment.com and register. It's only $30. You get, in addition to the seminar, I give you an ebook and some other great tools that go along with that. I've had fantastic feedback regarding this workshop that I've been doing, so I decided to do it again. Some people were asking if I was going to do it again, so it's out there. And again, make sure wherever you're listening to the podcast, you hit follow or subscribe, share the content. That's, you know, the best way, you know, help us grow our show by inviting other people to listen to the show. Tell them about it. And I got to say a big shout out to my buddy Mason Maxwell, who did just that. I did a show in Grand Forks, North Dakota on Sunday, and I met a comic there, Richard, who was on the show. And we got to talking, and I mentioned that I lived in Sioux Falls, and he was like, oh, do you by chance know Mason Maxwell? And I was like, I do. Mason is one of my good buddies. And I said, it was a funny story. He actually recognized me from a podcast when we met at a comedy club. And Richard interrupted my story and he said, was it The Art of Bombing? And I was like, well, actually no, but you should listen to that podcast because that's my podcast. And so Mason's been telling people about the podcast, so I appreciate that, Mason. I love you, buddy. Hope you're doing well on all the disc golf that you do over in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin area. All right. So, again, subscribe, share the information. If you have a bombing story and you haven't had a chance to be on the podcast, you can go to theartbombingpod.com, and there's a tab where you can submit a bomb. You can either call the Bomb Squad hotline, or you can type it out. I might include it in an upcoming future newsletter or an episode of the podcast, so on and so forth. Make sure you give us that five-star Make sure you give us a five-star rating and a nice review wherever you listen to this podcast if they do it. Mostly Apple Podcasts. That's, I think, where it helps the most. I would definitely appreciate it if you did that. And finally, if you want to support the show financially, there are two ways you can do it. You can go to you can support my efforts by going to buymeacoffee.com/dbubcomedy. Or you can join the Patreon. I know I've been slacking on Patreon. I got to try to get better at that. But if you want to join the Patreon, that is patreon.com/artofbombingpod. But again, the best way that you can support the show is by subscribing and telling all your friends to subscribe and listen to this podcast. And finally, when you're on the website, doing your things on the website, maybe you're buying some merch, maybe you're submitting your bomb, maybe you're just checking out to see what's on there, make sure you sign up for the newsletter. Got a lot of positive feedback on the previous newsletter because I wrote a big piece about booking yourself independently. This next issue of the newsletter, it comes out around the beginning of the month. So the August newsletter, I'm going to continue that by talking about ways to save money while you're on the road. So I'm going to write a piece about saving money to give some little tips and little things that can help you save some money while you're out on the road. So, all right, that's enough of all this. Let's get into this great conversation with Mike Kaplan. Enjoy.
And now it's time for the stand-up soundbite.
Sometimes you'll be in a bathroom, I bet, and somebody will knock on the door and they'll say, "Is anyone in there?" And then it's your turn. What do you do? You're probably like, someone's in here. And that's 100% correct. You nailed it on the first guess. That's exactly what they're looking for. Is anyone in there? Someone's in here. You can say that. But did you know that you don't have to say that? You know, you could say is anything. Literally anything that you say will let them know that someone's in there. You understand? Give it a shot. Hey, is anyone in there?
I love you.
That'll do it. You could maybe say something meaningful and political that you care about. Make a point. Hey, is anyone in there? Black Lives Matter! Get a meeting started, you know? Get some solidarity going. You could give them some trivia, maybe, that you know and they don't. Help spread some information. Share education. Hey, is anyone in there? The longest sidewalk in the world is in Tampa, Florida. It's 4.5 miles uninterrupted. This is the way that a priest sings. Not sure why, if God created everything in the universe, including every musical note in every octave of every scale, he still prefers every Sunday to be serenaded with songs that have only two notes. In fact, it's mostly only this one note until the very end when it goes down to the other note. But what do I know? I am merely a Jew. Our songs are pretty shitty as well. Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. That one's our biggest hit song. Sounds more like an ambulance than music. Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. Maybe that's why Jews become doctors. You could yell that from the bathroom, is what I'm saying. You guys. Here's my favorite thing to say if someone says, "Hey, is anyone in there?"
"No one's in here."
They're not going to be like, "Hey, you lied to me."
Are you in St. Louis now, or were you in St. Louis last weekend?
I was in St. Louis on Friday night performing, and then I've come to Kansas City now.
Okay.
Where I've been, my girlfriend and I are staying with her mom for the past couple days, and some siblings, and then I do shows in Kansas City Thursday through Saturday this week.
Nice. At the Comedy Club of Kansas City?
That's the one.
Nice. Yeah. I was just there a couple weeks ago I stopped by their open mic. I was just passing through Kansas City on my way to some other shows. It seems cool. Like a pretty nice club.
Very nice. I haven't been, so I'm excited.
Nice, nice. And then I see the following week you're at Acme.
That's right.
Yeah, which that's a great club. Everybody knows that. So.
Oh yeah, I've been there a few times. Recorded a couple albums there. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's definitely a nice space. That's awesome. Now it's good that things are opening back up and comedy is happening again.
I am glad it is safe and healthy to do so under lots of the circumstances.
Yeah, yeah, that is for sure. That's for sure. Definitely still got to try to stay safe. I don't know how it is for you. I mean, I'm vaccinated, but still, there's some places where I go, especially in the Midwest, where I'm like, better bring my mask.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I am heartened by the numbers that if you are vaccinated, which I also am, that we are safer.
Yeah,
we are, you know, that most of the danger is for the unvaccinated. And also one never knows, like, the, you know, there's lotteries that can be won in both directions.
Yep, that's for sure. Well, it's best just to try to be as safe as you can. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good that we're getting back out on the road. You got a lot of good shows coming up. We'll get right into this. I don't want to keep you longer than I have to, but we'll talk. This podcast is about bombing. You've been doing comedy for quite a while. I actually been a fan of yours for a while, but before I even started stand-up comedy, I remember you from Last Comic Standing. So I'm sure you've got plenty of stories about a time, about shows that didn't go so great.
Oh, no, they all went perfectly. I mean, it's, of course, like, when you start, I feel like, I mean, I didn't conceive of every time I went on stage at an open mic or every night of my, you know, first several years, I didn't think of those as bombing, but I feel like, you know, on a technical level, probably, but like, I feel like, you know, an open mic, I remember hearing somebody on Mark Maron's podcast once talk about, like, when I started doing comedy, I knew it wasn't going to be easy. And so I hoped that if I wrote 20 jokes or 30 jokes, I tried them all out at an open mic, if one of them worked, then I'd take that as a sign to keep going. And he's like, and two of them worked. So, he's like, it was double what I expected. So I think, you know, if you go into something with I feel like I don't know what the technical definition of bombing is, or what the agreed upon is, or what your definition of it is, but I'm gonna posit this one for now, and I'm happy to, and if this definition of bombing goes over well, then great, and if this definition bombs, then so be it. But I feel like your prototypical bombing is like doing, like, not being well received when you have an expectation of being well received, like, which I think would sort of disqualify from the definition. Like, you can't, anybody who's not doing comedy is not doing well at comedy, but it can't just be not doing well at comedy, because if you're not trying to do well at comedy and you don't think you can do well at comedy, then I feel like, this checkout, the checkout guy at the grocery store is really bombing. He's like, I'm not even trying to be funny. Yeah, I mean, like, I'd do way better than that guy. So I guess the one that springs to mind mostly, I mean, it's sort of like a spectrum. Like, over the years, you know, eventually you get your 5-minute set that works on most gigs, where all you have to do is 5 minutes. Then you get your 10-minute set and that works, or your 15, your 20, or your 30. And you feel like, you know, you're building, you know, a rickety structure that you're like, I can stand on this most of the time. And then, you know, some big bad wolf audience comes and just blows it down. And you're like, oh, I guess, you know, I thought I had a half hour of comedy. Turns out I have 3 minutes. I thought I had an hour of comedy. Turns out I had 2 minutes. I thought, didn't you have 3 minutes before? I was wrong about the 3 minutes also. And so, I mean, the one that leaps out is, I forget, I should look up exactly when this was, because it was either towards the end, I started out in Boston in about 2002 doing comedy, and I moved to New York in 2008. And I forget if this is a gig that was like right before I left or after I left and I came back to the Boston area, to actually Cape Cod. So I performed at this place, the Cape Cod Melody Tent, which was an outdoor venue, like under sort of a big tent that, as the name would indicate, I believe it sat maybe 2,000 people, like, and it was in the round, which is kind of weird for comedy, but good. I've done some comedy shows there that have gone well, and this was, I was opening for a band. I was opening for Casey and the Sunshine Band, which also... Opening for a band can be great if it's like if the people know, if the fans of the band are also, you know, potentially fans of comedy or your style of comedy, or like Eugene Merman is a comedian who I feel like has worked with bands a ton. Like, I've been on lots of shows where they're like, oh yeah, there's musicians, there's comedians. I was actually, the last show I did before the pandemic was on a cruise ship, and it was on, it was the Joko cruise. Are you familiar with it? Mm-hmm. There's a musician named Jonathan Colton, who has, he's written music for video games. He's written a lot of stuff on, for television shows. Like, he's super, I mean, his music is really enjoyable. And also he is, it is comedic. Like, he's not a stand-up comedian, but he is friends with a lot of comedians. His music is funny, on purpose when he wants it to be. And he, so Jonathan Colton, or Joko for short, he, about 10 years ago, started just like saying, like, it would be fun to get my fans together on a boat, on a ship, and started doing it, and has been doing it for the past 10 years. Like, this past year, the pandemic was the first time that they, 2021 is the first time they didn't do it in person at all. But in March of 2020, we set out on March 7th, we got on a ship, and we were out there when the pandemic was decreed, like several days later. And we thankfully, I think everybody was safe and secure and healthy. As far as I know, we got off the ship, we got to our homes, and then didn't leave them. But that ship, the community that he has fostered in his, you know, thousands, a couple thousand people of his fans who know what to expect on this boat from him, from his music, from the comedians he invites, from sci-fi writers, from gaming people, from comic book authors, from podcasters, musicians, comedians, all these different artists who are like, you know, if you went to a comedy show and there was like, actually, first, there's going to be a podcast taping that you've never heard of, and you're like, oh, that's weird.
Yep.
Or if you went to, you know, a reading of your favorite sci-fi author, and they were like, actually, there's going to be a funny musician first, you'd be like, oh, that's weird, I guess. But this was like, if people know what they're expecting, like, so they like, music, comedy, sci-fi, comic books, like, all these things, like, there's people who love all these things. And so all that is to say, that's what was happening on the Joko cruise, and that's not what was happening at the Cape Cod Melody Tent, where I don't really even understand why some bands have an opening act. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, I know why I have, as a comedian even, like, there's some comedians who just come out themselves, do an hour and a half, and because their fans, the fans don't need to be warmed up. The fans have been warmed up by the rest of the career yeah. of the comedian. And so the tour that I'm doing now, the show that I'm working on is called Imperfect. And I actually really enjoy, so it's like an hour ish that sort of set that it's still, you know, there's still some like editing and tweaking and moving some things around and riffing and finding new things. But for by and large, if I had to record it tomorrow, I could. It's an hour that exists. And I've been doing it, like I did it at Union Hall in Brooklyn near where I live a couple weeks ago, and I invited a couple other friends to be on the show. And so I came out and I hosted. I came out, like, I'm like, I know I'm going to do my thing at the end, and I'm happy to, like, it. I feel like it's sort of a, you know, the superstitious, like, bride before the wedding thing. Like, oh, you don't want to see the comedian do comedy before they're the actual, like, it doesn't really even make sense. But so I like going out, and like, I've seen other comedians do it. Like, I remember Doug Stanhope, the first time I saw him was on a tour that he had started called The Unbookables.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the Boston area where I lived, and there was like a friend of mine was on the show, and then he brought a few other people that he was touring with. So it was like three or four people on the show before him. And he came out, and at the top of the show, he didn't do a set, but he was just like, this is my show, like everybody on it. I invited to be here, so please just don't be an asshole to them. And it was, you know, he said things that were funny but weren't part of his comedy. And then, you know, and then he introduced either the host or the opening act or whatever it was. I forget how it went. But I was like, that's really cool. And, like, I feel like the way that I used to think might have been like, oh, man, I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to, like, I want to just save my stuff, like, you know, you open it up, you warm them up, you, you know, quote, take the bullet.
Yep.
And trying to think of a less violent way to express that. You eat the food that is not as desirable. You eat the salad. I enjoy salad as well. That doesn't do it. So, and so I like that now. Like, I don't feel like I quote, I need an opening act. Like, I'm happy to come out and be my own opening act. I'm also happy to have friends on the show because it's nice to have friends and offer stage time to other folks and be a part of a community. This is all to say, I don't know why it's like a band like Casey and the Sunshine Band, who they know what they're doing. They could just come out and do everything. Like, I don't know. I sincerely don't know why. Like, if they had a comedian they loved or a band they loved, like, ooh, I'd love to have this person out there. But it just seemed like I was picked because, I mean, there was not room on the stage for another band. Like, it was a tiny stage. All their equipment was there. They're like, who can we get that won't move a lot and is small? Get like, ooh, get a small comedian. Like, oh, this tiny Jew will do. And so then the people coming in, I feel like the band was to come on at 8. And I was starting at, I was doing like 7 o'clock I go on. And I was supposed to do 25 to 30 minutes. That's what, and so after me is intermission. So it's not even like I'm establishing a bunch of momentum and like, and now the band! I'm like, and now relax and get some more drinks and they'll be out soon. So, and the stage was rotating so that, you know, as people are entering, they're not there to see me. They don't know actually what's happening. It's not, I mean, it's not their fault. They don't even know, like, that there would be comedy. Like, oh, it's maybe some people understand. Oh, it's a comedian. I get it. I don't have to listen. Doesn't matter. It's not what I came here to see. But people are like, oh, is it like somebody doing announcements? Like, clearly the band hasn't started yet. We're fine. Let's just get our seats, get our popcorn, get our drinks, whatever it is. And so meanwhile, I'm doing my show. I'm like starting a joke to one part of the audience that's not listening. Meanwhile, the stage rotates and conclude the joke to another part of the audience that's not listening. Eventually, I think people got what was happening and started yelling for it to stop. They're like yelling, you know, this is sort of a joke, but I don't think this actually happened. But the idea was people were essentially yelling, get down tonight. And I'm like, oh, is that a request? Quest for me to take action to get off the stage, or that's the song that you want to hear from the band that you came to see. Probably both. There was at one point a little girl who I saw with just a thumbs down, and my friend Ken Reed is a very funny comedian from Boston who used to have a joke that he would tell. Maybe he still does about he has an it's an extended piece about the worst heckle that he ever saw or heard. But he said before that, he imagined that the worst heckle would just be somebody giving a thumbs down, like, because how do you argue with it? And I think that it's both the worst and the best, because at least compared to what everyone else was yelling when they were yelling, this didn't, like, throw me off audio-wise. It was just like, oh, but also I could be sure, like, if it was somebody's yelling something, it's not, it could be garbled. I'd be like, oh, I don't even know what they said. Maybe they were just ordering a drink or yelling to their friend where they're sitting. But a thumbs down is a very unambiguous, like, on one level, I'm like, oh, I see what's being communicated, and also I can keep delivering my comedy. So I'm like, and I asked the parents of the girl as I came around again. I'm like, who's that guy? It's not going super fast, but I'm like, hey, what? How old are you, little girl? It's like, oh, she's 8. So nice, you know. And I remember as I approached the end of the set, that, you know, if I had been presented, like if the audience knew it was going to happen, it would have been a different story. If I had known, if I had been booked with these terms, to be like, hey, how would you like $400 or $600 or whatever it was to come out and be yelled at for a half an hour? Would that be like a fun game for you to play? I'm like, I mean, yeah, 400, like hundreds of dollars for a half hour of work is great, much higher than minimum wage. I'm happy to. I do think I drove up from New York. So I think I drove like 4 hours, 5 hours.
Oh, man.
And maybe I did other shows while I was up there too, or maybe I just went up, did that, and came back. Either way, I've certainly been dining out on this story for a while. right now, this afternoon, and also whenever anybody asks me, because here's the thing. The really, like, what's the worst show you ever did? Really, the worst shows that I ever did, I've probably blocked out. Or probably they weren't memorable in this way. Like, if somebody... Like, I feel like when people want heckling stories, when people want the stories of the worst shows, like, they don't really want the worst ones. They want the worst ones that were cathartic in some way or redemptive or that they could hate watch. They're so bad that they're good.
Yep.
Because, like, truly, like, I mean, the worst bombing isn't somebody yells at you. The worst bombing is you say things and the audience is just like, I don't really understand what's happening. but we are, like, I feel like Patton Oswalt had a great story once about, like, very early on, like, just doing poorly. And, like, just an older gentleman came up to him afterwards and said something that made it seem like this person was so kind, such like a genuine, you know, a good citizen, a nice human being, that was expressing to him, like, I don't really think anyone understands what you're trying to do, so maybe this isn't for you. You know, maybe maybe there's something out there for you, but I think based on what I've seen tonight, that this is not it. Like, I know I don't mean for you to suffer, but also, like, I think that none of us wants to suffer as well. Hold on one moment. I've gotten so involved in the telling that I knocked my headphones / microphone out. So towards the end of my set, I remember saying to the audience, I'm like, look, I want to level with you. I mean, and here's the thing. There's 1,500, 2,000 people are still coming in and being seated during my set. Maybe that's what it's for. They're like, yeah, we don't want to have to, like, buy the rights to play some music while people are coming in and sitting down. Why not just pay this fellow to be confusing to all? And so I'm there. It's approaching the 25-minute mark, at which I'm, you know, mercifully allowed to stop talking. And I say to the audience, I say to them, look, everyone, like, I've been contracted to be here for 25 to 30 minutes officially. I might not guarantee get paid if I don't talk for at least 25 minutes. Like, your reaction notwithstanding, your reaction is, like, secondary, bonus, regardless. I'd love for you to have a good time. I'd love for me to have a good time. But clearly, that might not be happening until years from now when I tell people about you. But... I was like, I want to make you this deal. I want to make you this offering. I get paid. My job is to perform, is to stand here on this stage for 25 to 30 minutes. That means there's some leeway. There is some wiggle room in this situation. So just to be clear, the band doesn't come out any sooner if I finish sooner. So if you boo me off stage, they're still coming out at 8. And maybe you want 40 minutes of silence instead of 35 minutes of silence. But I'm like, but here's the thing. I'm definitely doing at least 25 minutes. And so I offer you this. If for the next several minutes, until then, until I reach the 25-minute mark, if you stop yelling at me, if you stop being the way that you are, if you stop being yourselves, if you stop treating me the way that you're treating me, then I'll stop at 25 minutes. But if you keep yelling at me, then I will do my full 30 minutes that I am authorized and allotted to do. So, like, if you want less of me, if you want me to get off stage sooner, you have the power. All you have to do is accept my bargain. And they did not accept my bargain. So... But I think I did about 29 minutes, a much more joyful story to tell while it was happening. I was like, this will be, at some point this will be a pleasant thing to tell people about, but because there's nothing, there's sometimes that it seems like there's nothing that I, look, maybe Jay Leno in that situation could have won them over. Maybe, you know, but there are circumstances by which, and I do believe it's always the comedian's responsibility to do the best that we can. Like, looking forward, like, if you're on the show and you see other comedians eating it, don't think, well, I'm going to eat it too. Be like, maybe I'm the one that's going to crack it open. Maybe I'm the one that's going to turn it around. Maybe they just like a certain flavor and they haven't had it yet, and I'm that flavor. And I've been in situations like that. I've been able to be that person at times, and I've seen many other people be able to do it because they're not just accepting defeat. They're like, you know, they say, believe you can or believe you can't, either way you'll be right. And so looking forward, there's always a possibility that it's gonna go perfectly. Looking backward, then it's nice to have these stories, like, after what did happen. Like, we never know what will happen, we can know what did happen. And this is certainly a more enjoyable tale to tell than, like, oh yeah, one time, many times, years ago, I went on stage and I told people a joke that I was sure was funny, and turns out we did not agree. And I was like, but sometimes other people agreed. My grandmother thinks that I'm funny, even though she probably wouldn't like this joke either. But yeah, I think the worst, it's sort of like the worst bombing stories are like this, as compared to the best bombing stories. The movie Battlefield Earth, which I did not see because I saw reviews for it. I saw it got like a 3% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's like the kind of movie that maybe I would have liked. Like, I like sci-fi movies. I like movies about space and aliens, like, when they're good and enjoyable. I even like movies that are silly and dumb and, you know, full of just, you know, action and no plot or whatever. And I remember looking at the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes for the movie Battlefield Earth, and seeing, like, you know, 97% bad reviews, 3% good reviews. One of the good reviews was something like, this is the kind of stuff that summer blockbusters are made of. And I was like, that's not even, they're just telling you that this is, that's when the movie's coming out. And it's the kind of stuff that they're made of, but I guess, like, not put together in the right, like, you have the ingredients, but you didn't cook it up right. Like, what? It feels like they're trying to say a nice thing, but they're not really saying anything. But the one review that really made me, like, that sticks out of my mind, it said, like, there are something like, I'm paraphrasing, like, there are movies that are so bad that it's enjoyable to watch how bad they are. And this movie is not one of those movies. So that, like, I feel like this story that I just shared with you about Casey and the Sunshine Band, like, that is enjoyable for me now, having not enjoyed the actual experience of it. But so many other stories of bombing are like the others, where it's like, I had my set list, I forgot everything on it after the first joke didn't work, and then I was like, "Hoo boy,
this is gonna be fun." You know?
Oh, like, yeah,
no, that's amazing. That is an amazing story, because there are so many elements that are out of your control. Like you said, ultimately it is up to us as comedians to take responsibility. But there's things like the spinning stage, like that. Even if it's going well, that's still gonna be hard to do, because, like you said, you're throwing a punchline to the crowd here. And by are throwing a setup, and then by the time you get to the punchline, it's a different crowd who might not have heard the whole setup.
Oh, yeah. It is so. And, you know, I just remembered another story that I don't tell as much because I used to be much closer to it. But I'm happy to say that I'm farther in the future. a separate story of, so I was on America's Got Talent in 2015. And it is now 2021. So I'm almost all different molecules. I mean, probably all different molecules, almost all different cells. Like, I don't know how it works, but I've grown a lot from since the experience, and maybe from the experience. But I got to be on three episodes of it. I did three sets of about, you know, 2 to 3 minutes each. The first two went great. The first one, you know, was, I think they only televised like 20 seconds of it. Like, I did 2 minutes of jokes. They went well. I talked to the judges. It went well. And I moved on. And then when it aired, they showed, I think, like, one of my bits, maybe two. Mm-hmm. But like a very short snippet. They're like, hey, here's a guy. And then the next round was the judges' cuts round, and that round they showed like a full, like they a 4-minute package where like they had me and my girlfriend and like this backstory of us, like we were living across the country from each other, and they had wanted me to be like, she's calling too much, right? And I'm like, no, I like my girlfriend. You can't write me a story where my girlfriend is annoying and bad to me. And so the story just that became the story. It was just like, I love my girlfriend. I miss my girlfriend. And so we were a part of it. And then I riffed with the, like, in answer to some of the questions that, like, Howard Stern asked. And I said things that, like, really, really hit. It really worked. And I think Neil Patrick Harris was the guest judge. And so one of them was like, oh, maybe you should try to, you know, do a show. You're really interacting well with Neil. Maybe you could make a show together. And I think I was like, maybe I'd prepared it in advance. I was like, oh, Neil Patrick Harris is going to be here. Will there be an opportunity? I don't remember if it came in the moment. But and I'm not saying it's the greatest thing that I've ever said, but I think I ripped it. And it was like, something like, I was like, oh yeah, our show will be called, you know, How I Met My Brother from Another Mother. And it was fun. They laughed. Like Howard Stern asked me if I was gonna, if I won $1 million or whatever the big prize was, he said, we know that you love your girlfriend, but if you win the million, are you gonna stick with your girlfriend? Or are you gonna play the field? And I was like, I'm going to stick with my girlfriend and play the field. And at the time, and people laughed. We were in an open relationship, so I also was telling the truth. But at the time, it seemed like a fun joke, whether you knew it or not. And so that happened, and then my set just went super well. And so this is all to say, this set going great, which is online, and you can see it. I think it's the America's Got Talent Judge Cuts, thing that they put together on there. That's a setup for when I came back to the next round. I advanced from that round, and then my third appearance was my final one and didn't go great. And at the time, I was like, oh, it really felt like, I was like, if it went the best, then I could have moved on, and maybe I could have won, and maybe I would have had even more, like, fans, which at this point, people did come out to see me because of that afterwards. And I remember doing a show, like, right after I was off the show, like, later that August or something. And it was a great club. I think it was in Grand Rapids. Or no, not Grand Rapids. It was in Ann Arbor, the Ann Arbor Comedy Showcase. Loved it. Been there a couple times. Always love it. And I remember a couple came up to me after the show. And they were, like, disappointed that the comedy wasn't all, like, family-friendly, that it wasn't all just about, kids and things that could be said on TV. And I remember I was telling stories about, like, psychedelics and, you know, other things that I wouldn't tell on television to an audience full of families. All that said, so that is what I'm grateful now that I'm like, what would have happened? I would have been grateful if I won $1 million. I would have been grateful if I moved on further and had, like, you know, a wider reach to even more millions of people. Absolutely would have been happy. And with what I have, what I did accomplish and what I did gain from it, I'm glad that there aren't more people who got tricked into coming to see me because they believed that everything that I do in my live act is identical to or on the same topic of, like, the 2 minutes that they enjoyed that I did on TV that I specifically curated for the America's Got Talent audience. Out of all the jokes that I've written, I'm like, oh, what are the jokes that I think would go best for this audience? The shortest jokes, the quickest jokes, maybe the most family-friendly jokes. And that's where I tripped up a little bit is I was working on material that would become an album that I called No Kidding, which is about how I don't want children. And basically the first joke is how I just say, I do not want children, let me finish, to exist at all. And so now I'm on TV, and I feel like that's, like, sincerely, like, right now I'm staying with my girlfriend's mother, who has 5 children that are at the ages right now of 7 through 15. I love them all. I love children, like, individually. I love performing for children. When I've performed for children, when I know that I'm going to be performing for children, it's super fun. And also, thus far and continually, I do not plan to nor want to specifically be a parent at this point. If at some point that changes,
I'm right there with you. I feel exactly the same way.
if I were a parent, if for whatever reason I found myself, you know, in circumstances where, you know, children were, you know, godfathered into my life, or if my life circumstances changed such, I'm like, oh, like now it seems like the right. But at this point and at that point, that was the truth of my experience. But sort of the headline seemed to be, you know, comedian does not like children. Meanwhile, everyone watching is like, hey, I have children, or I am children. And as such, that set, it was at Radio City Music Hall. It was going out live. And I'd been sort of warned that that room is like not even like the greatest for comedy. And like, certainly with everyone there, not specifically there to see me, not specifically there to see comedy, there to see America's Got Talent. That is another, a situation in which I, by my definition of bombing, of not being as well received at a time when you are capable of, I'm like, I've been doing well. The two sets up, 2 out of 3 on America's Got Talent, successful, a passing grade. And in life, I've been, you know, headlining since somewhere in the early, in the mid to late 2000s. You know, I think I did my first road headlining gig in maybe 2010. And so at this point, I've been, you know, working as a professional headlining comedian for 5 to 7 years, depending on how you count. I was like, I'm capable of entertaining audiences for an hour at a time. I've, at that point, I think, recorded 3 hours of comedy for albums and specials. And I was like, surely I can entertain this audience. I've entertained thousands of people before. I can entertain this thousands of people for 2 minutes. And as it turned out, I'm sure I entertained hundreds of people for those 2 minutes and probably thousands of people for some of those seconds. But ultimately, that was probably the highest profile, the largest audience that I've ever done, not my favorite way, in front of.
Wow, that's incredible. Wow, that's definitely a situation where I've auditioned a couple times for that show, and it's interesting how they try to, what they want you to tell, and you really do have to have that mindset where you're picking things specifically for their audience, because they do have a specific audience. And I wonder, because you were on Last Comic Standing, you were a finalist on Last Comic Standing before you America's Got Talent, because I think Last Comic Standing was there before. How did you feel like, which show do you feel like really helped kind of get you out there? Do you feel like it was Last Comic Standing because you weren't necessarily as known, or because of how big America's Got Talent is?
My understanding, because I did them in the order that you said, like it was 2010 was when I did Last Comic Standing. And that's also when when I was starting to headline places. And that was something that actually did help me start to, you know, have a name that people would come to see rather than just like, you know, a person who's maybe been on a show.
Yep.
Like I remember I went right from, like I was on the last, I got to the final episode of Last Comic Standing in the top 5. And so we're on a Monday night, we're learning who wins. And I found out that I didn't, but I got to be on the show for so many weeks leading up to that. And right after that, the next morning, I got booked earlier in the season because of being on the season. I got booked for my first appearance at Acme in Minneapolis, where I'm going. Nice. Very soon. And so many people came out because of that, like specifically because they'd see me. I mean, millions of people watched the show. Yep. And that made hundreds of people come to the show, which is like, that was the goal. I mean, I think most of the shows sold out from like two, like Acme is a very good club. And sometimes shows sell out there, even if you've never been on TV.
Yep.
Or weren't on TV the night before. But they would have shows Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 2 Friday, 2 Saturday. So like 7 shows throughout the week. And just, it was up to that point, certainly the best week I'd ever had, like headlining a club, performing at a club. And of course I'd also just started doing that, but it's also, I mean, it's such a memorable thing. But yeah, so to get back to your question, I think the first performance, you know, the first, that season of Last Comic Standing started in like March, and maybe it started airing in June. So like between June and August, I think I was probably on the show like maybe 10 weeks in a row or 10 times over the course of those several months. Like sometimes, like again, the first clip of me might have been only like a joke or two or a minute or, but then eventually you're in the semifinals, you're in the top 10, whatever it was, like when you were in the top 10, I think that we did like, you know, 1, 2, 3, at least 4 sets then. And there must've been at least like 3 or 4 before this. Maybe I did 8 sets total over the course. That's, you know, it's two minutes every time about, yep. But still there's several million, I forget the exact number of people watching it every week, but it was like several million people watching it every week, in, you know, primetime network television on NBC. And so, and it might not be the exact same, you know, if it was like 3 million one week, it might be a different 3 million or, you know, like a couple, maybe there, I don't know what the overlap is, but the point is that I feel like the fact that it was so regular, that it was, you know, week after week, and it was like, you know, promoted on social media, which was becoming more and more of a thing at the time. And so, yeah, I think people would, you know, sort of start like noticing me on the street like a couple times a week, I feel like. And so definitely prior to that, like I'd been on a couple, like a late night television show, I'd been on Comedy Central, and I'd been on this, I don't know if you know the podcast Keith and the Girl, but Keith and the Girl, they were before I'd ever been on pretty much any television, they are the reason, I feel like Keith and the Girl and Last Comic Standing are the two things that people come up to me after shows and tell me, I first saw you or heard you here. Like they've been doing a podcast since like daily, essentially since 2005.
Oh wow.
They've
done like pretty much podcast started.
Yes. All podcasts are spinoffs of Keith and the Girl. I think, I don't know, other than maybe like Never Not Funny, I don't know really any other podcast that's still going today that was going since the mid 2000s. But yeah, so they were the first people like who really, like they have fans all over the world. And so like kind of wherever I go, there's always at least a few people that are like, hey, we first heard you on Keith and the Girl. And so, but after that, then it was Last Comic Standing for sure. And I feel like certainly America's Got Talent, I'm very grateful to have been on it. And there are definitely people that found me because of it. I think for the couple times that I was on it, there were like a larger audience than Last Comic Standing. But Last Comic Standing, I mean, the other main thing about it is that I got to do exactly what I want. I mean, I did choose the jokes that I did on America's Got Talent. They did have people who were like, you know, sort of helpful coaches and guides to be like, you know, definitely you can't do this, but of the things that you want to do, like you can choose from your own material to do what you want to do. But there was even less guidance or anything. Like on Last Comic Standing, I decided what I was going to do. I was like, these are the best jokes I have that I hope will get me to the next week. And hopefully this will get me to the next week after that. And then this and this. And if they don't air this, then I can do that next time, you know?
Yep.
So yeah. So I think, I do think that Last Comic Standing is for sure the thing that it's all been a gradual series of steps, yep. You know, that like I started in Boston in 2002 and all I wanted was to make my living doing comedy, just, you know, which the first way that I was able to do that was I got a college booking agent. And like the reason that I wanted to get on TV was so that I could get a college booking agent. And I got a college booking agent through this other sort of roundabout way by performing at these different festivals that I was invited to perform at and competitions. And then in like 2007, 2008, that I was able to finally support myself from stand-up. So like that was the first, like it was kind of the Seattle Comedy Competition or the DC Comedy Fest in 2006, 2007, that really like made it, like, sort of paved the way for me to be able to only do comedy, for me to not have to have a job that wasn't comedy, like working at a cafe that I was working at, working at a technology company that I was working at. And then in 2008, I moved from Boston to New York. I left grad school and I just for the first time lived by like paying rent and buying food and only working in comedy, in show business, in creative life. And so 2008, 2009, like that, things were continuing to sort of like move ahead, slowly, gradually, surely. And Last Comic Standing was a thing that in 2010, like did like, boost it to, a slightly higher echelon, wherein, people did start to come to see me because they knew who I was.
No, that's great. Yeah, that's awesome. The reason I was curious, because when you were talking about being on America's Got Talent, you were talking about the couple that came to see you, and then they were like, whoa, you're not what we thought. You know what I mean? Because that does happen. And I think about this a lot, because so I primarily work clean. It's just how I just worked out that way. I just filmed the Dry Bar comedy special. But now I've noticed people are tight casting me, and, you know, Dan's a clean comic. He's a clean comic. And I'm getting labeled that. And I feel weird about it, because I'm like, well, I work clean, but that doesn't mean I'm a clean comic. Like, because now if I drop a profanity and somebody comes to the show thinking I'm just a pure clean comic, you're going to have that where they're going to be like, well, you said whatever. And it's like, well, I'm not the one marketing myself this way.
Yeah, I understand. I guess all you have to do is just put out one video called Wet Bar, you know? And I'm actually doing a Dry Bar taping in about a month as well.
Nice.
And looking forward to it. Also going to delve back through the annals to find words that don't look too much like annal. And
good plan.
Yeah. So I guess a question I have, so I have joking advice for you, which is to, you know, you can take like, be like, hey, clean comic goes dirty, you know, just like put out a yeah. video of your adult material, be like, there's also adult material to let everyone know. I mean, because it's sort of like what we were talking about before. If you want to see a certain kind of comedy, or if you want to see a certain comedian, like, you probably can. All you have to do is learn what do you want to see? Yep. Who do you want to see? Where is it happening? Go see it. Like, of course, you know, you might not have control over the opening act. You know, if you're going to see Casey and the Sunshine Band, you're like, that's the music I wanted to see. The opening act didn't do any Casey and the Sunshine Band songs at all.
Didn't even play an instrument.
Yes. But so what I hear you. You're like, it's a very reasonable thing that as long if you're doing your best to just do the comedy that you want to do. And then if people are like, oh, it seems like you're clean. So we'll market you as the clean comedian. You're like, meh. You know, like, yeah. I mean, like, if it would be, I feel like, you know, if you're hired to do like a corporate gig where they're like, we're paying you specific money to be the yep. clean comedian, then you can put on that hat and do that.
Absolutely. That's, yep.
But yeah, I mean, I'm sure for the Dry Bar taping, you did as recommended.
Yeah.
And so how was the experience for you?
For me, it was great. I honestly, their production team and everybody involved are some of the best people I've ever worked with. You know, in comedy, we do a lot of gigs that are not always so great, where even the people that book you aren't that enthused about having you, you know, like even the people that book you treat you like you're nothing or nobody. And that's not the case. They treat everybody like superstars. Like I was like, wow. Like, I'm a pretty much unknown comic, and they're treating me like I'm one of the most famous comedians in the world. This is amazing.
That's beautiful. I love to hear it. And now my expectations are raised all that much higher.
I've heard only... For me.
I've heard wonderful things about them. But, yeah, it's... I forget where we are in the middle of now. I wanted to ask you how your experience was. You told me, yeah. That's I've done my two things. My joking advice to once again just make a filthy tape so that that's out there so that people know that you're like, hey, look, come to the early show and see Clean Dan. Come to the late show and see Late Dan.
There you go. That's good. That's actually pretty good advice. Joking aside, it is actually pretty good advice. Yeah, because it's really all about the marketing. It even goes back to you opening for Casey and the Sunshine Band. You know, if people know what they're getting into, they're going to, you know, if they know that there's a comic opening, they're going to be ready for it. They're going to be more open to it. You know, it's just like when I call it hijack comedy, and that's when there's a show or an open mic that surprises a bar. That's why it doesn't work. Most of the time, the bar doesn't know that a show's about to happen. They're just there, and then suddenly, oh, we're going to tell jokes at you.
Oh, yeah. When people sometimes ask me, like, what do you think, like, what's your ideal audience? And I'm like, I guess it's one that knows the comedy show is happening and if, moreover, like, wants it to be happening, and like not only just knows it but wants the specific show that's happening. Like, you know, people, it doesn't have to be people who know me. Like, I'm sure that when I go to Acme next, there'll be a lot of people who have seen me there before. Yep. Or have seen me on TV or in other places, heard me on podcasts before. But even so, there's almost always some people that are like, that see you for the first time. Like, no matter how big you get, there's people, I'm sure, way wider reach than I have, that, like, you know, you've never seen them live and you're like, oh, maybe I'll go see them. Or, you know, a friend's like, you gotta check out this person. And so there's always the possibility, until everyone in the world knows who you are and, you know, has an opinion and is like, all right, I'm into it. There's always the possibility that, like, there's new people coming to see you for the first time. And it's pretty exciting.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I got a few things that I like to ask, just some standard stuff that I like to delve into, and then we'll get wrapped up. One of the things I always like to ask, and especially comics that have been doing this for a while, the bumming of bombing, the dreadful feeling you get after a bad show. How does that affect you, and how has it kind of changed over the years for you?
Sure. I mean, I would say, the experience that I have, like, of it recently that comes to mind is, like, getting back out, you know, performing live in New York City where I live. At first it was sort of like one at a time, like one show a week. And then I got a couple, and then now it's sort of back to the, when I'm there, like, you know, some nights I have three shows, some nights I have one, some here and there. And sometimes, you know, you're going from show to show, or I'm going from show to show, and, like, one, you know, some of them are going to be like, make me feel better than others. Yep. It's always my favorite when, you know, when the last one makes me feel good. You know, I mean, I'd rather, if I have like seven shows in a row, I'd rather have six great ones and one. Yep. Then, but also I do know that if I had six ones and the last one was great, I'd be like, that was a pretty good night of comedy, you know?
Because yep,
also I record all my sets, generally speaking, and I listen back. And I found that, like, there's a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. Are you familiar with this book?
No, I'm not, but I'm going to write that down. Thinking Fast and Slow?
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful. It's so full of information on every page that I'm not giving you any here until right now. There's, he's like a social scientist, I believe, the author, Daniel Kahneman. And a Pulitzer Prize-winning one? Or maybe a Nobel Prize-winning one. A prize-winning one of whatever he is. And maybe economist. Okay, so is Kahneman an economist? Here it is. There was a drill sergeant, I think, who was like, the author was like researching, like, is it better to give people positive feedback or negative feedback? Like, positive when they do well or negative when they do poorly? And this drill sergeant was like, I find that I get better results when I yell at people when they do poorly than when I praise people when they do well. Like, if one of my pilots flies the best they've ever flown, and I'm like, that was great, the next time they almost always do worse. But if people do the worst that they've ever done, and I yell at them and like, hey, do better next time, they almost always do better next time. And what turns out is happening there is not actually, like, he is not correct in his assessment of why they're doing worse or better. It's that if you do the best that you've ever done, you're probably going to do worse next time. If you've done the worst that you've ever done, you're probably going to do better next time, regardless of whether anyone's praising you or yelling at you. It's called something like, I don't know if it's gravitation to the mean, reversion to the mean, something like that. It's like, you're going to head towards the average. If you do an extreme, you're going to move towards the average next time. Statistically speaking, like, because, you know, if you imagine you run the fastest that you've ever run, then the next time you're probably not going to run even faster.
Yep, that's true.
Like, great work. And so similarly now, to your question, I feel like when I've had sets that I felt like have been the best, like I've specific sets over the past maybe five-ish years when I started performing, like not only at comedy clubs, but being able to like, you know, book some small theaters, some independent venues, like working with like local folks who like really, you know, get, instead of doing, you know, a comedy club four show weekend, just do like a slightly larger one venue, one night. Like there's a place in Durham, North Carolina that I've loved called Motorco that I've been to maybe three or four times. And I just love it every time. And I remember maybe the first or second time I was there, just I did like an hour and 20 minutes, like when I was planning on doing only like 45 to an hour, just like, you know, the set that I wanted to do happened, but also there was all these different paths, all these riffs, all these like, you know, fun explorations that happened. And I remember being like, wow, that what a beautiful, magical time. And then like, I don't always listen back to my sets immediately, but so probably like months later, I listened back and I was like, it was good, but now, by that point, some of the riffs had turned into bits, and so some of the magic that happened in the moment, like, wasn't necessarily recorded, like, the way that I felt while it was happening wasn't the exact way I felt while I was listening. I was like, oh, like, I'm glad that I loved doing it while I was doing it. And similarly, sometimes when a set I feel like doesn't go as well, when I feel inside that it didn't go as well, when I listen back, I'm like, oh, that was fine. Maybe it was just, like, one bit that usually hits a certain way didn't, or yep, one, you know, one, like one up top didn't do, I got in my head and then the rest of it was fine or great. And so like similar to like the expectation or the memory of it is not necessarily like valid, you know, we yep, don't, which is why I'm glad that I record and I'm glad that I now strive to like not take personally, like if something doesn't go my favorite way, because also I know when things go my favorite way, it doesn't even mean then that when I listen back, they'll have been my favorite way forever etched in stone. And so my goal is always to, you know, learn something. If a set doesn't go my favorite, why? Like is, or what didn't, or what did work? That's my favorite thing is to be like, in a set where most things didn't work, what did work? And be like, oh, maybe that's like, is that a, you know, a bulletproof, a salad proof, you know, is that one, is that joke now something that, so I feel like sometimes when I have shows where everything is landing, if one thing doesn't work, I'm like, oh, that's a nice data point to have. And for shows where everything isn't landing, if something does land or does take off, does fly, I'm like, I'm glad for things to not land because that means they could be flying. And I really like, so that's, I don't feel great when, you know, when an audience doesn't respond the way that I want them to, that I'm accustomed to them, that I'm grateful that they often do. It definitely, you know, I feel like it used to sit with me for longer, maybe because it would be like my good sets to like, you know, sort of wash that taste out of your mouth, you know, the have a palate cleanser. I mean, I also, so I think that now the next morning, every morning, I generally start with a routine of drinking a liter of water, reading something peaceful by a Buddhist author or somebody else who I, like, you know, really just want to, like, mm-hmm, envelop my consciousness in. And then I'll meditate, and then I'll do some free writing. And that is a thing that sort of, like, is a nice reset or a nice set for the day. So even if, like, I can remember, like, a few weeks ago, I have the vague, hazy shape, like, a dream of, like, a show not going well, and or, like, I forgot to do a joke that I wanted to do, or, you know, I didn't prepare as much as I wanted to, and so it went fine, but not great, and, like, now that I'm recalling it, I'm like, oh, I remember exactly where it was when, but for a little while, I was like, oh, it's just hazy and in the past, and I'm no longer, like, living in the reality, the illusion that negativity, like, feels like it's going to last forever, but I know intellectually that it doesn't, that, mm-hmm, you know, every emotional state that I've ever been in, until right now, has gone, has changed, has come and go, and so I feel like that's the thing that is no longer present. It used to be, I'm like, oh no, what if I'm never good again? You know, what if it's this sadness forever. I don't have any proof that it's not going to be, but now I have a lot more data points to suggest that how I felt 3 weeks ago is not the way that I'll always feel.
No, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful and beautiful. That's like a beautiful way of thinking of it, because that's something too for me over the years that I also look at different sets too. Like if it's an open mic, I don't really consider that bombing anymore. But I think about that a lot, where it's like, you know, people who come up to you and they're like, "Oh, I don't know how you could do comedy," and you know, I've had that happen, and it's just like, well, it's not that bad. I look at it this way: it's not the worst possible end result. If I go up there and I do 45 minutes of jokes and nobody laughs, guess what? Tomorrow, I'm probably waking up and it's a new day. You know, like
probably
waking up. It's all good. This isn't the end of the world.
Yeah. I have a bit about this on my newest album, AKA, about people asking that question.
Oh, really?
And people say, like, how could you, you know, how do you do it? How do you get up there every night and risk that rejection? And I say, well, I'm sure now I'm going to, you know, poorly paraphrase my own bit that I haven't been doing regularly for a couple of years, but... the idea is essentially how do I do it? Well, I think about, like, what's the worst thing that happens? Is a room full of people hates me and then I never see them again. And I think about that and I compare it to high school, where it was a whole building full of rooms of people and it was the same people every day. Like, so in order for this night to be worse than that, you'd all have to hate me and then afterwards tell me, "We'll see you tomorrow," you know, and every day for the rest, for the next 4 years.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, that's great. I was going to ask this too. I was curious about this because, you know, you've done a lot of filming, you've done some albums and stuff, and I'm curious your take on this. Do you ever look back at like a set or like jokes that you did? Because even when you're talking about, look, you know, listening back to your sets, we're like, oh, that went as great as I wanted it to. And then you realize, oh, maybe it wasn't, or it's evolved. Do you ever look back at stuff that you put out and you're like, oh, man, I wish I could do that now because I'm a lot better comedian than I was then?
A good question that I'm going to answer in a couple different ways. Number one, sort of tagging on what we were just talking about. There, I was in between shows at the Eastville Comedy Club sometime in the past couple months, this year definitely. And these two guys were there who were like aspiring comedians. One of them had maybe taken a class, one of them had maybe been on stage once. And he was like, "I'm a little worried that I'm going to get up on stage and I'm afraid that no one will laugh at me, that I'll be rejected." And I was like, "Oh, well, the good news is that fear is about the unknown. And so what's to your benefit is you can just know that no one will laugh at you. You can know that you're going to be rejected. So you don't have to be afraid of it. You just, that's what's going to be. That's what it, like, it'll be a rare bonus and eventually a more regular thing that people won't respond to you that way. But for sure, like, you're almost definitely, like, it's guaranteed, so no need to fear. Just know this to be so. There's a few albums, like, I remember I recorded the special, my special called Small Dork and Handsome, and it came out, like, a year later. And by that point, I mean, my goal is always to be, like, working on a whole new hour to be ready eventually, that... Like, I do now, sometimes when I go back and revisit old jokes, like, if I'm readying them for America's Got Talent or for, you know, the dry bar taping or something else, I'm like, oh, like, I've got a new tag for this 10-year-old joke that, like, if I was continuing to tell that joke, of course it would evolve and I would find new things about it and, you know, connect it to other things in my life now that weren't happening then and experiences in the world that weren't present then that are now. But I remember very specifically, like, it's so funny, the way my journey with this even experience I'm telling you now, I had a joke that was like, I think it was about I said something about like a half man, half horse, but it wasn't about a centaur. But then I realized that it could be about a centaur, but I'd already recorded it. And I was like, oh man, if I'd only just said centaur. And like, so I started when I was performing it live, I'm like, oh, now that's how the joke goes. And there's like an extra laugh because somehow the way that I got, I don't even remember exactly all of what it was. And the point is like, for a while I was like, oh man, I missed an opportunity to record a thing in a specific way. And now I'm like, oh, I don't even remember exactly what that joke was. And I don't even think if I could tell it today, I probably wouldn't tell any of it. Like, I think that there's some jokes on like my earliest albums that maybe even more recent ones that if I knew then what I knew now, I'd be like, I wouldn't say this that way. I wouldn't talk about this topic in this way. I would like, so the idea that, oh man, I could be my 30-year-old self so much better at 40, but I'm more busy being my 42-year-old self now. And so the point is that like, I mean, I write so many more jokes than I even could share. So like, I mean, it's kind of nice, like, I would rather have an old album that I look back on and be like, that would be better if I did it now, than to be like, well, that was the pinnacle. I'll never be better than I was as a child, you know?
That is a fair point. That is a good observation on that.
If you're unhappy with the way that you were in the past, that means that you are happier with the way, that means that you're growing. Like,
yep.
Here's a joke that might be in my, it's not in anything I've recorded yet. It might be in my next hour. It might be in a future one. It might never be, but it's basically the truth of my experience that when I started out in like 2002-ish, I thought I was good. Like I had jokes, some of them worked and I was like, I think I'm good. And then like a year later, I looked back at like a tape from that time and I was like, ooh, that was not good. Thank God I'm good now though. And then a year later, I look back and I'm like, ooh, that was not good. Thank God I'm good now. And every year I look back and I'm like, thank God I'm good now. Never learning until eventually now I'm like, now I look back a year and I'm like, could use some work. But, I mean, that's hopefully the way it will until you or we or anyone is like a divinely enlightened Buddha master of comedy, like where you are omniscient and all seeing, all knowing, and can thus, you know, or your Chappelle, whatever is the equivalent. I can't speak for anybody. I'm glad to still be growing, to still be, you know, coming up with ideas and, you know, different ways of structuring and presenting and, you know, delving into, you know, my experience and life more and potentially better that, or at least differently than before. Like there is to know that there is still growing to do. And maybe someday I will go back and re-record the old album minus the bits that I would do differently with them added in better and differently. I mean, kind of doing the dry bar taping is going to be a version of that. It's going to be a kind of best of the past. Oh. So,
well, there you go. Second chance, I guess. No, that's a really good take on that. Because you're right. Because I think about that, when I look back at stuff that I recorded, because that's the thing. A lot of times when you record something, it takes a year before it even comes out.
Yes.
So you've grown a year as a comedian and as a human, hopefully. And then you look at that and you're like, ah.
Oh, yeah. And
I could have done that
one other.
Now,
yeah.
But.
One other specific experience about this is, so before I was doing comedy, I was an aspiring singer-songwriter, and that's how I sort of got into comedy, which I had some funny songs, and I played them at a comedy club. And so 2002 is when I say I started doing comedy, pursuing comedy. The first time I ever performed at a comedy club was 1999, my senior year of college, but I was only doing music, just comedic songs, talking a little bit in between, but I wasn't really writing jokes, wasn't trying to be a comedian, was just trying to perform wherever I could, mainly music venues. So between 99 and 2002, I was performing all these different music venues around Boston, including this one place called Club Passim, which had an open mic every Tuesday where I'd go. And I eventually did start, like, I would, if you had 5 minutes, I'd tell like a 2 minute joke or 2 minutes of short jokes and then do a 3 minute song. Mm-hmm. And they had a guy recording every show and you could pay him like $15 to record, to get a copy of your set from that night. It was, you know, pre a time when you could really record on your own and extensively without a lot of gear, and like pre-smartphone for me at least. And, but I remember, so for the course of like 24 weeks, I think I did, I paid him to give me the sets that I recorded. And I, so I did, I ended up with 12 songs and 12 tracks of jokes that were recorded at this open mic over the course of, you know, 2 months. Is that 3 months? 24 weeks? 6 months, I guess. That's,
yeah, that's more than 3 months.
Yeah. Oh, wait, maybe it was only 12. Maybe it was only 12. Yeah, so 12, yeah, 12 weeks where each week I got a track of jokes and a track of a song. So 3 months. That sounds
there we
right.
Go.
Yeah, there we go. We get, the math is all, we got it. We can move forward with the story. None of it matters. I got, so I had this track of 24, the CD of 24 tracks that I called Open Mic Night, spelled Mike the way that I spelled it. I was like, what a wonderful creator I am. And the songs are all songs that I've been writing songs since I was like 15. And so now, you know, this is probably, you know, like I've been writing songs for like six, seven, 8 years. And I was like, I like the songs. I would share the songs with anyone. They're still like, you know, me at age, you know, early 20s or whatever it was. But I like them. I like them as songs. The jokes, some of the jokes would go on to be like jokes that I would tell in my comedy that I'd record on future CDs, but some of them would not. And it was also like, again, over the course of 3 months of open mic, some nights I'm going on at 7:30 PM. Some nights I'm going on at 11 PM. Sometimes the room is full. Sometimes the room is empty. It's like, clearly it's at an open mic night. And so it's a nice artifact to have at this point, but for a while, from like maybe 2001, again, before I was starting doing comedy, it was the only record I had of, it was the only thing, literally the record that I had. And so I remember in 2007, 2006, 2007, I went, do you know NACA? You're familiar with National Association of Campus Activities, which is what enabled me to help to sort of make my career be a possibility. That was what enabled me to get gigs enough to pay my rent, was getting booked at these colleges. And so I got to do a few showcases, and it was weird. Like, usually you don't do the same region 2 years in a row, but in the Mid-Atlantic region in Pennsylvania, I think both times, there was like a festival 1 year that was like smaller, not all the schools came. And then the next year was like the full on region. And I got accepted to both of them, and I performed, and it went well both times. And after the first one, I remember I gave out those CDs. I just gave out, you know, the CD that I had to be like, hey, in case you like bring it back to your school, if you want to remember who I am. And the next year, and I, you know, I booked maybe a few schools. The next year I booked a ton more schools. And in part because I think a guy came up to me afterwards, after my set, and he was like, hey, your set was really great. I saw you last year, and I remember it also going really great. But after all these things, we've seen so many comedians. We sometimes now in today's day and age, like you'd have a website, you have YouTube videos. But at the time, like we only had like the materials that people gave us. Mm-hmm. You gave us this CD. I remember when we listened to it later, like it didn't evoke the performance that you had done, because this performance is now like, I don't know, for me now, I know it was like 6-7 years in the future, like 6-7 years of actually starting to do comedy, you know?
Yep.
And as opposed to just doing it in between songs at an open mic night here and there once a week or so. And the guy said to me, he's like, this album is not representative of the comedy that you're doing. He's like, so, you know, not, you're not asking for my advice, but I would stop giving people this album in hopes that it will remind them of the performance that you just gave, which was a great one. And I was like, that was so memorable for me. Like, so now, like at that point, I was like horrified. I was like, oh no, so many people I've given this album to and they think it's good. But I'm like, now I'm like, oh yeah, now I'm like, oh, what a younger version of myself to feel that way, which makes sense that he felt that way, that I felt that way. But now I'm like, oh, isn't that like, now I would just, similar to the theme that we're talking about here, like, I don't think that I'm bombing on this album anymore, even though at a certain point it might have been valuable to assess it as such. But now I'm just like, oh, this was like a child version of myself doing his best. And And now I'm like, isn't that fun to share? Like, now if anybody wants to hear those songs, like, I will offer them with like the disclaimer of like, these are jokes from before I did comedy. These are songs from when I was barely done being a child. And so that's how I would conceive of, I guess I'll strive to conceive of bombing that way as well. Actually, I have a new joke I'm working on that's sort of relevant that, sometimes, like, when I'm on stage now, I'll be, like, riffing and writing, and sometimes it goes places. Sometimes, you know, it goes to a non-place. And
sometimes, exist.
Yeah, sometimes you're like, oh, non-place, that is where I am now. Oh, well, let's back up and good night. And so the joke is about how I understand, like, when I first saw Picasso paintings as a child, I was like, these are bad. Like, these don't look good, right? Like, he's tricking us, right? Is the emperor's new Picasso? What's happening here? And then I learned that, oh, he's capable of creating, like, photorealistic images, but he's choosing not to. And I was like, that's his art. And so I'm like, well, now I'm like, I'm not saying that I'm like Picasso, but I would love for everyone to listen to all of my albums that are full of curated pieces of comedy, like beautiful joke equations and, you know, and scenes and presentations that where I'm like, this, I am capable of doing this. And I'd love for everyone to listen to those. Listen to my most recent album, AKA, and then have that inform whatever nonsense is happening right now on stage. I'm like, I'm just trying to do some abstractions of like, I think this is something. I'm pretty sure this, if Picasso could do it, I can do it. And so that's, but any bombing that I do now, I'm like, that's just an abstraction of a future set going well.
That's a good perspective on it. That's a good way to look at it. I love that. That's great. All right. One of the other questions I'd like to ask, you kind of already talked about, because you talked about listening to your material and stuff. But this is a fun question I like to ask, because I'm always curious what goes through people's minds. When you tell a joke and the joke bombs, or you feel like you're losing the audience, what is that first thought that goes through your mind?
Oh, I guess, I mean, it really depends on the circumstances. Like, if it's something new, then it's part of the deal, you know?
Yep.
I'm like, oh, that's, I feel like Stephen Wright put it that, that he's like, if I tell a joke three times and it doesn't work, I don't think that it wasn't funny. I just think that they didn't agree with me. But for something that has been like reliable, something that, you know, works almost every time. And when it doesn't work, I guess now maybe this is aspirational, but my hope is to find it a curiosity, you know, to be like, huh, how about that? I wonder what's happening here, as opposed to, you know, like dead panic. Be like, oh, well, if that doesn't work, then what, if this is going to work, then, oh, God, if this whole house of cards is going to come crumbling down. Like, I would have, I used to have this opening line that would work so reliably. And when it didn't work, I was like, oh, I think this set, maybe this set won't go well. Maybe that set up the expectation and maybe I behave differently as a result of it. Maybe it was like, you know, a Heisenberg type of thing, the observer effect or whatever, you know, making it so that it is different now that this thing happened. But the thing that's different is me, not the specific external thing. Like my goal, my hope is to always be like, even if something doesn't work, maybe the next thing can work. Maybe the next thing can work. But I would have some jokes that they would have multiple parts. Like sometimes there would be, you know, a clear setup and a punchline, but sometimes there'd be bonus punchlines throughout the setup, bonus things along the way, you know, tags. And like the idea, like for the best audience, it would be like this explosive, you know, combo deal, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 punchline situations where even the worst audience, practically speaking, might not laugh at everything, but at least when I got to the end, there'd be some recognition, like, oh, that's the end. We made it to the end of the bit. And I'm like, oh man, there was so much fun you could have had along the way. And so I guess sometimes I'm doing calculating when those things are happening to be like, oh, like I often like to start a show riffing. And if I can riff like as indefinitely as possible, then wonderful. Then like the best audience might get none of the prepared show, but they get a, you know, beautiful new experience. Whereas the worst audience that doesn't like riffing at all, they'll get the A material delivered just by rote. And as such, Yeah, I guess I might be. And then I guess I don't. If I'm doing like the hour that I'm doing, where like the hour goes a certain way, I haven't as yet, like, ever started doing it and then decided to stop doing it somewhere along the way. Mm-hmm. I guess that could happen if I'm like, oh, this crowd will not appreciate, you know, if I, because I never know. I think that's sort of arrogant to say, like, oh, if you don't like that, then you won't like this. So especially the hour that became AKA I did at Edinburgh, at the Edinburgh Fringe Fest in 2018, like 25 days in a row, just this hour with one break, I think one day break in the middle. And it went great a lot of the time. And then some nights the audience was smaller. Some nights the audience was a different quality and or quantity. But still, the goal was to do the hour, you know, almost the same way every time, to learn it, to figure it out, to, you know, breathe life into it, to be like, this is how it goes. And so in the past, I think I might have felt like, oh, how do I recalibrate? I'm like, if that direction didn't work, then maybe this direction will go. But I think kind of like an arranged marriage where they're like, well, this is who we are. We're together with. So, and they actually end up, I feel like people in arranged marriages I've read end up ultimately happier in the long term because they know that there's no out. They're just like, well, they have, we're accepting this. We are together. We want to, like, we want to be happy. And so we'll learn. And so I feel like sometimes doing the show and not giving myself permission to bail, which I really do have, is an advantage that can help, you know, ultimately strengthen my own resolve and the show in general. But yeah, I guess it's hard for me to say exactly what goes through my mind when it's happening. I guess I start thinking about, like, what is the next thing that I will say? Like, is it the thing that I've prepared, or will I take another direction?
Yeah, maybe go out on a riff.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Yeah, well, if it's the worst, yeah. I would, if it's like the worst case scenario, I honestly might then be like, honestly, what is happening? Like, who yeah. are we? Like, do we all speak the same language that I speak? Like, are we from different places? Like, did you expect Kevin Hart? Like, what is going on? Like, did, you know, like, I feel like some comedians make jokes like, what happened here before I got here? You know, like, did something happen? Like, in all of your lives, in one of your lives? Like, did I miss something? Do I not know? Like, I would love to learn. I would love to connect. And sometimes, you know, abandoning the script is the way to do that.
Yep. No, that's very, very true. I've seen that happen multiple times where, you know, a set wasn't going well and the comic did just that. They just were like, okay, let's back up, figure out what's going on here. And then they proceeded to go forward and did fine. Sometimes you just have to hit that reset button.
Yeah, I think I heard a story about Marc Maron that I might be sort of, you know, not getting all the beats, but my understanding is I think he did like a Comedy Central roast, maybe of Chevy Chase or something. And he's like, I'm not a roast guy. So it wasn't going great. Or even though I wrote jokes, but it just wasn't going great. And at a certain point, and sort of they were always like, just don't admit that you're bombing. Don't admit it. Just like, just keep going, move through. And eventually, and he was doing that, but he's like halfway through, it's just like, I have to say something. I have to be like, look, I know this is not going well. And talked about, was himself and talked about the experience that he was having that probably gave the audience permission to be like, oh, thank God he knows, you know, like, did he think that this was going well? Oh, good. He knows this. And like a sigh of relief is breathed collectively. And then he's like, look, I heard a story about Hedberg once. Headlining a club where they were not getting him at all, but he at like the 30 something minute mark, he's like, guys, I know this isn't going great, but I need this gig to make money for me. So the owner's going to poke his head in about 10 minutes and I'm going to signal you. And if you guys would do me this kindness so that I can get rebooked here again, just like whatever's happening at that time, will you respond as though you're really enjoying the show and have been the whole time? It's like, you don't have to come see me the next time, but it helped me get rebooked here. And they did, because there was like a real moment of communion and human connection, even if not comedic connection, but sometimes like one can beget the other.
Yep, yep, absolutely. All right, well, we'll get wrapped up. I got a few more questions, some fun stuff. I have a Art of Bombing playlist where I add songs that get you pumped up, not necessarily for comedy, just even to exercise or whatever. Is there a song that gets you moving?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure that Lose Yourself must be on there. But I like, so there's a bit about Kanye in AKA. So when I was, and there's a bit about the Beastie Boys. So before my shows in Edinburgh, I would always have them play Beastie Boys' Get It Together with Q-Tip from Tribe Called Quest, one of my favorite, I think my favorite Beastie Boys song. That song is like pretty chill, but also a Beastie Boys song. And then, so that would happen right before the show began, and then I would come out to Kanye's All of the Lights. And I'd be like, that chronology, is that what I want to say? That really did it for me.
Nice. Got him. Sweet. And then we talk about, on this podcast, I talk a lot about the bad shows, and you've had some incredible experiences in your career so far, and I'm sure you'll have many more. But up until this point, do you have a gig that really stands out as one of your favorite gigs?
I mean, there are really, truly so many, and this will sound corny, but also is true that, like, the show I'm doing right now, I'm so excited to be doing, it's about my relationship with my girlfriend, among many other things, that who I've been with for 5 years and who has, like, contributed a lot to this show and the last hour that I did. And so and she's on tour with me right now. And so we've been, when she was with me in Edinburgh, like, all those shows were amazing, but, like, getting to do those shows. And then afterwards, the next day, she would, like, tell me, like, hey, you said this way last night, and you've said it this way before, or, like, what about this? I feel like, or this doesn't actually make sense the way you're saying it. Would this make more sense? And I was like, you're right. And so, like, getting to collaborate with, you know, my girlfriend, who I love, my partner, is, like, a really wonderful opportunity. So I love all of those. And so on these particular shows, on this, the tour that I'm on right now, I did Morgantown, West Virginia, Cincinnati, Ohio, and St. Louis, Missouri. And all three of the shows were pretty, like, packed with a high quantity of a high quality audience. And so I got to do the hour and also stretch out and, like, discovered a few new things that, like, I said something for the first time on Wednesday, and then Rini, my girlfriend, was like, that was great. Have you thought about doing a callback to it here? And I did it the next night, and it got one of the biggest reactions of the night.
Awesome.
The next night, having never said it before, 2 days earlier. And then the St. Louis show was also just at this beautiful black box theater that reminded her and me, vicariously, of Edinburgh. And it was just curated so well, and just, it was so interesting because, like, I think the night before, the two nights earlier, the audiences had, like, skewed 20s and 30s, and I feel like the St. Louis price might have been a little higher, and the theater was a different venue, and so I feel like the audience skewed, like, 40s and 50s more, but even so, I feel like that audience was even, maybe because I was talking about marriage, my relationship, like, maybe it hit chords in older people slightly differently than it would in younger people. I'm like, my comedy is ageless. It is for all. But like, but that show, like, the most, sometimes I feel like I would answer, like, the show that I'm doing right now, the most recent show that I'm doing, is the one that I love the most. And also, that does happen to be true. Like, that St. Louis show was a beautiful comedy experience. And then, I mean, there have been so many other times that I've gotten to, like, open for, you like, sort of, you know, heroes. Like, I've opened for Maria Bamford a couple times and Patton Oswalt a few times. And I was just thinking about a time that I opened for Kathleen Madigan, that she said something really meaningful. She said a bunch of meaningful things on and off stage. But I remember, like, asking her if I could, like, a buddy of mine had just started opening for another guy, like, on the road. And I was like, if you ever need me to, like, open for you anywhere else. And she was like, well, the reason that you're opening for me here is that I don't bring openers with me. And so she's like, I love to just, like, let the local comedy scene blossom. And I love both. Like, I love traveling with a friend. I love having openers who I know. And I also love going to a town. And if there's somebody there that I know, like, best of both worlds.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess, I mean, in answer to your question, I'll say St. Louis, July 16th to 2021, and also many other opportunities.
Awesome. All right, the last thing I like to do, we play a game called Pick a Number. You'll pick a number between 1 and 20, and I'm going to ask you the corresponding question. It may be related to comedy or it may not.
Okay. I pick one number between 1 and 20?
Yep.
4.
4 it is. All right. Which character would you be if you were in a sitcom?
Oh, in any sitcom?
Any sitcom.
Okay. I guess, you know, there was a sitcom years ago, sort of animated sitcom called God, the Devil, and Bob. And I would be God.
Nice. Excellent. Yeah, that's great. This has been fantastic. Thanks again for doing this. Go ahead and tell people where to find you online.
Sure, thank you.
Social media.
Oh, yeah. So Mike Kaplan is spelled M-Y-Q. And Kaplan is spelled K-A-P-L-A-N. So at Mike Kaplan on all the social media, wherever you can put it in, .com, my email, you can find me. I've got a new newsletter that I send out free every week. And you can subscribe for more via Substack. So MikeKaplan.substack.com. And every week there's at least several jokes and or other units of fun, along with information about, where you can find me live and or live streamed. And my social media should do that as well. Just, just find me everywhere. And I do have podcasts of my own. One is called Broccoli and Ice Cream, where I have conversations with people about the work of their life and the joys of their life. And The Faucet is a podcast that is just me, where I just turn on the faucet of talking. Like, imagine it like this conversation, but without you there. And with only listening, with only you listening and only me talking, and maybe sometimes listening to myself. And I guess mainly I'm a stand-up comedian. I'm performing live again and still sometimes live streamed as well. So if you go to MikeKaplan.com, my dates are there. If you're somewhere that it doesn't seem like I'm coming, ask a place that's near you to bring me there. I want to be wherever people want me to be, by and large. And in the meantime, if I'm not where you are, I do have a number of stand-up albums. The most recent one is called AKA. I'm super happy with it and super proud of it. And would love for you. It came out last year during the pandemic, so it's still, kind of new and hot off the warm off the presses. I almost said hot off the freshes, which I like also. But yeah, if you could only do one thing, you don't have to only do one thing. But if you only did, then I would say listen to AKA because I love it a lot, and then do all the other things that you want to and can. So thanks for having me here and offering this.
Excellent.
This has been brought to you by Dead and Mellow. Follow us on all your social media platforms and shop around at deadandmellow.com to see all of our stand-up, music, and podcast releases. Thank you, and God bless America.
All right, see you later.
See you. Are we actually leaving or just it?
The Art of Bombing is a Blitzed Entertainment production. Hosted and produced by me, Dan Bublitz Jr. The stand-up spotlight bumper was produced by Joe Nicola Music. The Art of Bombing theme music was written and performed by John Holt. All other music was used under Creative Commons licensing. All stand-up audio clips were used with permission from the comedians. You can help the podcast by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating, and a review. For previous episodes, merch, blogs, and more, please visit theartofbombingpod.com. And remember, stay safe so you can live to love.